Anon Radio.
Hello, this is Julian from the Stoke Source Radio Show. Stoke Source is the station that I play music that interests me, sounds and tracks that intrigue me, and among other things, space junk, ideas, demos. Tune in at 8 a.m. UTC, or for my Australian friends, 6 p.m. AEST. See you then.
Hey, this is David Poe, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Greenville Drive-In 32, a destination for movies and music under the stars of the Northern Catskills since 1959. Seasonal programming information at drivein32.com or 518-966-2177.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Scout of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
There is currently no vaccine or specific medication to treat COVID-19. Testing is limited in the United States. The only way to flatten the curve is through collective action. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend that all Americans practice social distancing to slow the spread of the disease and to keep from overloading the American medical system. This means staying at home and avoiding other people.
Palatial administrative offices, fountain included. Hello and welcome to the Thingularity Radio Program, broadcasting from the Palatial Administrative Offices of the Catskill Makers Syndicate, located at 65 West Bridge Street, right next to the Juice Branch. How is everybody doing tonight?
Yay!
Yeah!
Okay,
great!
We are all definitely alive, and our guest tonight is Christopher Carson.
Pleased to be with you!
Yes.
He is... somebody you guys might already know because he's been on the show before. He's been a spectacular guest, and we're looking to have another good, fun night tonight. To my left is... what?
Go ahead.
Intro, so people know who we're talking. Ben, to my left.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. Brian, hiding in the back.
Yo!
Albert, how you doing?
Hey there.
Cody?
Hi, y'all.
Hey, and Professor Vaughn, Mother's Bob.
Yo.
That is everybody, and now you kind of know what they sound like, but we will get jumbled. Anybody got anything they want to bring up tonight before we dive into the guest, or vice versa?
Whoa!
Diving into him. We won't be getting into moon colonization, I don't think.
No, that was last time.
Ooh, do we have a topic available? Anything? Anybody? Grab bag. Don't make me start pulling out random words.
I think he had a conversation starter of some kind that had to do with a mug. We don't have.
Yes, I have here, and those of you on the radio can't actually see it, which is your loss. This wonderful commemorative mug, which says Rochester Gas and Electric, world's longest commercial Westinghouse reactor run, 189 days, July 22nd, 1973. Now, for those of you who don't know about Rochester Gas and Electric, this is a commemorative mug. It's got a picture on it of the Paul R. Genet Station. Paul R. Genet Station is a single-unit nuclear power station near Rochester, as you might imagine. It is the second oldest by a month and pretty much the smallest nuclear generating unit in the United States today. The one that's a month older is actually Nine Mile Point, also in upstate New York. Hmm. Now, interesting thing about this, Paul R. Genet, who was he? Well, he was a utility executive who firmly believed in the potential of nuclear energy. He was the head of the Power Reactor Development Corporation, which built the Enrico Fermi Fast Breeder Reactor outside Detroit.
Brian?
You may have encountered a book that went by the title of We Almost Lost Detroit, which described an accident which occurred at the Enrico Fermi Fast Breeder about 1970. It should be pointed out that no one was in danger of having their city blown up or anything of that nature. Actually, the most interesting thing about it to me was that there was fuel melting and that the reactor was actually then repaired and decontaminated, repaired and returned to service, which is one of at least three incidents I know of where a sodium-cooled, liquid sodium-cooled reactor actually suffered a fuel melting accident and was repaired and returned to service, which is really quite interesting. Anyway, but...
Wait, could you tell me about when that occurred?
Right about 1970.
Okay.
The Enrico Fermi, anyway, that's a story for another day, but the Paul R. Genet Station, so yes, this is commemorating the longest commercial power run of a Westinghouse reactor, 189 days in 1973. Now, you might ask yourself, I mean, now, that was when the station was nearly new. It's over 50 years old now. It'll be 52 years old come December 10th. Surely, you know, 189 days, that's almost half a year. How is it performing nowadays? Well, if you go to the International Atomic Energy Agency's Power Reactor Information Service, you'll learn something quite interesting. Because IAEA, P-R-I-S, that's your mouthful of letters for the day, tabulates availability factor of nuclear power units. I don't know anybody who tabulates this for any other kind of power unit, but IAEA, P-R-I-S, tabulates it for nuclear units. And Genet performs remarkably well. In 2016, in fact, it shows 100.0% availability, meaning that it ran all 365 days of that year without stopping. The previous and subsequent years, 94.9%, which tells you that they were running 18-month fuel cycles with a 90-day shutdown for refueling and regular maintenance. Anyway, so that's actually kind of amazing that this 50-year-old-plus power plant is running pretty much 350 days out of the average year.
But I thought nuclear is dangerous.
I mean, is it dangerous? Well, one thing I can tell you is that this, like I say, 50-year-old power plant, which is still achieving regularly better than 90% load averages, that kind of tells me that these plants must be well-engineered, well-constructed, well-maintained, and well-operated, or otherwise they'd never be able to do that. On the other side of the lake in Ontario, right, earlier in the year, at Darlington, one of their units came off a continuous power run of 1,102 days. Wow. Now, Genet or other U.S.-type power reactors could never do that. That's not physically feasible because they have to refuel roughly every 18 months. When they were first built, they refueled every 12 months, but the fuel handling has been modified over the years, so they refuel every 18 months, typically. Whereas the CANDU reactors that they use in Canada, those are refueled continuously. So they never have to shut them down unless either something goes wrong or they have some kind of scheduled maintenance or inspection or whatever. So which is, you know, Darlington Ontario. Unit 2 was shut down on schedule after 1,102 continuous days of operation.
So what you're saying is the United States did it better?
No.
So far as I know, this is not just the longest continuous power run of a nuclear power station. It's the longest continuous power run of a steam power station of any kind ever.
And this is Mile Point.
So that was Darlington. That was okay. Darlington in Ontario. Darlington, like I say, across the lake.
The Canadians, not...
Okay.
Yeah.
The Canadians got it right.
Okay.
Now, 9 Mile Point. Let's look at 9 Mile Point Unit 1, right, which is the other, like I say, Genet and 9 Mile Point 1 are the oldest and smallest nuclear units operating in this country today.
Fun fact, I grew up next to 9 Mile Point. I spent a large part of my adolescence 6 miles away from it. That might explain a thing or two.
6 Mile Point.
But yeah, and so here's a fun one. According, again, to IAEA PRIS, availability of 9 Mile Point Unit 1 during 2020, 100.0%. It did not shut off either on schedule or because of a failure of equipment or anything. It ran continuously.
Wait, this is 2020?
During the entire year of 2020.
That's the, okay. So the pandemic. So during the pandemic, it had no issues. Day. That's okay.
As a matter of fact.
I'd just like to kind of point that out.
As a matter of fact, it shows an annual load factor of 101.6%, which is to say it was actually generating more than its rated output.
Wait a minute.
Does that mean that it was getting drawn from more? Because doesn't nuclear just kind of add to the base load and then other sources come online during peak power?
So 101.6 annual load factor, what that really means is the rated load is based on a certain outdoor temperature. And so during the colder months of the year, you can actually run the power plant harder. And that's probably what that reflects. But yeah, nuclear power plants, now they can vary their output. Some can and some can't. I ought to be more honest here. Some nuclear power plants are dedicated baseload units that cannot vary their output meaningfully. Most units can, but they don't. Why do they not bother? Well, the answer simply is that their very, very low variable cost of generation means that you don't save much money by cutting back to 50% output. The cost of a kilowatt hour from a nuclear station is pretty low. So the more kilowatt hours you can sell, the better off you are. And again, we're talking about 9 Mile Point and Genet 1, right? 9 Mile Point 1 and Genet, which are more than 50 years old. They're completely paid off, right? The mortgage for those was paid off in 20 years. So every kilowatt hour that they generate is essentially pure profit.
Right.
Interesting.
Now, that's the power of nuclear. We're still paying off those solar panels.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing. People talk, you know, people laugh. They say, oh, yeah, they promised us nuclear energy too cheap to meter back in the 50s. Well, ignoring the fact that was a speech by Admiral Louis Strauss, head of the Atomic Energy Commission, talking about fusion. The fact is, nuclear energy too cheap to meter is a reality. The point is, too cheap to meter doesn't mean too cheap to charge for. It just means that the cost of a kilowatt hour, the incremental cost of a kilowatt hour, is meaningless. And so you just charge, you know, it would be more economical to charge people a fixed fee than to bother and find out how much they used. And how do you know when this is happening? Well, I can tell you it's happening in Ontario. Why do I know it's happening in Ontario? In Ontario, they set the electricity rates quarterly. Well, if you look at Ontario electricity rates, it turns out the rates are highest in the spring and fall and lowest in the summer and winter. In other words, they're inversely proportional to the number of kilowatt hours taken out of the system. Power loads are lower in the spring and the fall because it's temperate, higher in the summer because of air conditioning, higher in the winter because of heating. Well, the implication here is if power costs are essentially flat, right, no matter how many kilowatt hours you draw from the system, it still costs you the same, then why would you even bother charging people by the kilowatt hour?
Because it's profitable, extremely profitable.
Just figure out, okay, you've got a 100 amp meter, we're going to charge you X amount. Now, for industrial customers, maybe it's a different story, but for domestic customers, but that in some ways, when you look at smart meters, the whole point of smart meters is to eliminate the cost of sending some guy around to read the meter. If they had to pay somebody to go around and read the meter, it might not be worth it. It might just send you a fixed bill every quarter.
I would also like to interject, that's exactly what the company does to me. I have an old school meter that's not smart. It is very dumb. And I have to go out and every so often take a picture of it and send it in so that literally, literally Central Hudson doesn't spend the entire year guessing at my usage.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They do that for like the whole year and you gotta send them a picture.
Speculative.
Do you tie the thing to a leg of a pigeon when you send it, or?
Yes, I have to carry your pigeon, the photograph, I'm sorry, the mimeograph over to them.
Oh, Jesus.
Shapirograph. No, I've got a friend in Nevada who specifically pays an extra fee not to have a smart meter because at least the ones in Nevada, some of them caught fire.
Okay.
What kind of batteries they putting in there? Lithium?
Oh, wow.
I
didn't know Samsung made meters.
They're talking about putting dumb mechanical. Even smarter water meters here in Catskill because the batteries ran out on some of them and the water department charged thousands to the people whose meters ran out.
Okay, so they've got water meters powered by batteries, not by, say, a little turbine in the water pipe that runs on the water.
I don't know, Chris,
you're thinking, stop it, it's dangerous.
Well, that
of course, you know, the other one is smart gas meters. Do you really want a big package of electronics connected to your gas meter? Is that really a good idea?
I like rolling the dice.
The insurance doesn't care, so we consider it gambling.
So all these reactors that you've been talking about, are they would they be considered once through sort of uranium based fuel?
So that is the current situation.
Yeah.
You know, that is the current situation.
Do you find that kind of wasteful?
Are we talking thorium reactors here?
No, not thorium. Okay. I'm just bringing up the idea that we put the fuel through once and then, you know, then we're done with it.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. This is purely a legal situation. You may not know this. The United States used to reprocess fuel from civil nuclear power reactors. In other words, take the fuel, separate out the reusable uranium, the reusable plutonium, and the fission products, which is the actual waste. Your typical, from the kind of nuclear power plants we have in the United States, typically, you know, your discharge fuel composition is 95% reusable uranium, 4% fission products, and 1% plutonium. Yep. Now, in West Valley, New York, south of Buffalo, there used to be a nuclear fuel reprocessing plant with a capacity of about 400 tons a year, which is not particularly large. But it existed in the late 60s and early 70s. They shut down to expand the plant and then were never able to reopen it. Firstly, because of additional charges, regulators decided that they needed additional reinforcement against seismic loads. Now, I don't exactly, if you're familiar with the geology of the Great Lakes region, you know, the United States Geological Survey says that the likelihood of an earthquake of above magnitude 5.5 is essentially zero. So that's a bit weird that they'd be required to have special earthquake reinforcement against an earthquake that's never going to happen.
No. Don't say that. They can happen.
300 to 7,000 years, but yeah, it is a black swan.
No, not even on a scale like that. There, earthquakes in this region are possible. And it's, you know, they didn't guard against the cold in Texas, and look what happened to their windmills. So,
wasn't the cold. That was the 5G they injected in it.
That was the liberal conspiracy. The damn hippies were climbing the towers.
I've actually been through a magnitude roughly 5.5 earthquake, oddly enough, here where I live in Fort Worth. Now, it's not, the epicenter was not here. The epicenter was up in Oklahoma. But as far as how far it reached, it was actually really far reaching. Now, that was an interesting case. People talk about fracking and they talk about earthquakes. As it turns out, it's not the fracking that gets you. It's the disposal wells where they pump down this, you know, used water and brine that came out of the wells. Some idiot up in Oklahoma did not read the geological survey maps properly and started pumping this water into an old meteor crater.
Wow.
As it turns out, the strata underneath meteor craters are heavily fractured, and there was a big shift, and so it produced a low-magnitude earthquake, but one that was felt for hundreds of kilometers. So here, I mean, I noticed the house shifted. I thought there was had been a gust of wind. You know, the big wind comes along, I hear the house shift. If that was like that, and then I noticed that I had a pocket knife hanging from a magnet, and it was just rocking back and forth gently. I said, huh, that was an earthquake! This area is not known for seismicity.
Oklahoma is now in earthquake zone thanks to lots of pumping into the ground, right?
Yeah. Anyway, but, you know, this is one of those things.
I'm moving along.
Back to the reprocessing facility that never got reopened.
Yeah, so that was the one and only commercial nuclear fuel reprocessing facility that ever operated in the United States. In Barnwell, South Carolina, a facility with a capacity of 2,000 tons a year was built in the late 70s. It's never been allowed to open. First, there was a moratorium, and then basically the investors who owned the plant said, we don't know if we're going to be allowed to operate it. It doesn't make sense to start it up. Anyway, but to give you an idea of where we're at currently, in the United States, there's roughly 80,000 tons of discharged nuclear fuel, mostly sitting at the sites of the power stations it was discharged from, either in cooling ponds or in dry casks. Now, you may say 80,000 tons. Boy, that sounds like a lot. So a typical large coal-fired power station, the Cumberland Fossil Plant of the Tennessee Valley Authority, for example, burns 20,000 tons of coal a day.
Mm. Yep.
So 80,000 tons is actually not that huge an amount. Now, if we had a 2,000-ton-per-year fuel reprocessing facility, like the one that was built at Barnwell or like the one the French have at Cap La Hague, which I've been near. I actually took the ferry from Dublin to Cherbourg a couple of years ago, and it actually goes right by there. We could reprocess all the current spent fuel in 40 years. Now, why is that important? Well, again, I said composition is roughly 95% reusable uranium, so 75,000 tons of uranium of roughly 1% uranium-235 content. You can't efficiently use that. You can use that in the kind of power reactors we now have, but not efficiently. To use it efficiently, you'd want to use, for example, Canadian-style heavy water reactors. I don't know. Am I coming through at all?
You are. Yeah.
Okay.
Just like,
sorry, I'm just the dogs barking in the entryway is just driving me nuts here.
We can
here.
Hear it, but we can. But it's pretty low compared to you.
Okay. Okay. Good. The mic is supposed to be directional, but I'm never sure how directional it truly is.
It's doing good.
It's doing its part.
Yeah.
Okay. So, 76,000 tons of reusable uranium, 800 tons, let's say, of plutonium, of which 500 tons is plutonium-239, the fissile isotope. The remaining 300 is plutonium-240. Okay, so what does that actually give us? Well, for example, the French are in the position where they would need to re-enrich their recycled uranium in order to use it in nuclear power plants that they already have or ones they might be building. Because there's a rumor that President Macron is going to announce 6 new 1,500-megawatt nuclear power units before Christmas. Now, why would he announce that? Well, you may have noticed the price of natural gas is kind of high.
Yeah, in Europe.
Yes. And the Germans are supposed to shut down half of their remaining 7 gigawatts of nuclear on December 31st.
Yeah, and they've already decommissioned so many of them.
Yeah, where are they going to get replacement power? The Belgians? So Belgium actually got to 50% nuclear power before France did. But a series of hostile governments have made it impossible for the Belgian electric utilities to invest in replacing those plants. So if they're taken out of service next year, which is the plan, basically 40, the biggest single chunk of Belgium's electrical generating capacity just goes bye-bye. And there's no plan, right, for replacing that.
What, everybody can't jump on a bicycle and start generating their own juice?
That's the COP26's plan, right? Everybody has to start biking.
Yeah, that's where we're at, right? 26 conference of parties to the Rio de Janeiro Climate Accords. And after 26 conferences, what has actually been accomplished? I mean,
They're shutting down the cleanest source of energy that, Europe is the poster boy, or was, before
and
they started shutting them all down.
Private jets flew to that conference.
Not to the mega yachts and all that. Yeah.
You know, in quantitative terms, right, according to official figures, German emissions have not decreased at all since 1998. I've had people tell me to my face, oh, you know, Germany's 100% solar now. Mm-hmm. Somebody actually said that to me. German emissions have not fallen at all since 1998, and that's by official figures, which are probably somewhat optimistic.
Yeah.
You know, there's 26 conferences of parties to the Rio de Janeiro Accords, and...
The Germans are precise.
You know. And again, you know, you want to look at Germany and France, right? You can look at, for example, the IEA's key world statistic, International Energy Agency, which is different from the International Atomic Energy Agency. It's also different from, it's a unit of the OECD. It's different from the OECD Nuclear Energy Agency. It's also different from the United States Energy Information Agency. All these things have very similar names, and you can get really fouled up on them. But if you look at IEA key world statistics, Germany and France have about the same population. They have very similar economies in terms of GDP, industrialization, all that kind of thing. German emissions are twice those of France per head of population, per euro of GDP, or roughly in total, because, again, their country is about the same size. And the only difference, really, the only difference in the two economies is where they get their electricity.
And France is more heavily nuclear?
France is about 75 to 80% nuclear. The remainder is hydro.
Nice.
They have essentially no fossil fuel electric generation. There's a couple of fossil fuel burning plants in the country which are brought online a week or two in the typical year for when the loads get really high.
It's good to have
and
a
Germany
backup.
Germany has a certain amount of its baseload provided by fossils.
Germany has quite a lot of lignite. This is the odd thing. They've shut down their hard coal burning power stations, but they're still burning lignite, which is a dirtier fuel.
But is it like cheaper, then, more accessible?
The main difference is that lignite is typically strip mined, whereas hard coal is typically mined underground. Although that's by no means universally true, it is typically true. Near me, as a matter of fact, there is what's called Big Brown, which is one of the larger mine-mouth power plants in the country. In other words, there's a lignite strip mine right there in the middle of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, and a big lignite-burning power plant right there on the site. Well, it was claimed that they were going to, for environmental purposes, they were going to stop burning the lignite, which is mined right there, and start burning bituminous coal brought from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming by train.
Yeah, okay, sure.
Every day here where I live, right, every day, there's roughly 110 car string of coal cars, each of which carries 100 to 110 tons of coal, headed south to San Antonio for their coal-burning power plants. And, of course, the same string heads back empty the next day. And so between here and the Powder River Basin, there are, at any given time, between, I guess, 10 and 20 unit coal trains in motion. And that's just for the one set of power plants near San Antonio. But, you know, that's a thing, right? That
clean coal.
I was in Buffalo, New York in the middle of the night a few years ago, which is not something I would recommend to anybody, but, you know, that's how life is sometimes. I was in Buffalo in the middle of the night at the train station there.
Was it winter? Because the only way it gets worse.
I was sitting there, and down the line comes a unit oil train, 100 or 120 oil tank cars, probably moving. You know, it could have been Canadian crude oil. It could have been crude oil from North Dakota.
Yep.
But you know, that's the thing, is that you gotta keep the lights on. You gotta keep people warm, right? And if you don't want, you know, New York doesn't want fracking in upstate New York. Okay, I buy that. New York doesn't want pipelines through upstate New York. Okay, I buy that. Well, how are you gonna keep the lights on? How are you gonna keep people warm in the winter? Are you burning heating oil? Is that heating oil coming by train from Alberta, half on the other side of the continent?
We could do a lot of shipping with Hudson.
Up the Hudson. Yeah,
most of ours comes in by boat.
Even the trains down here. Yeah, the bomb oil trains. Cars
whipped right past.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and again, you know, this is a thing, you know, that just boggles my mind that, you know, Andrew Cuomo is gone. But before he left, he managed to succeed in fulfilling a long-term promise, which is to kill the Indian Point nuclear station, Buchanan, New York, you know, up the Hudson from New York City. Now, where does that leave New York City getting its power? Well, one answer is Ravenswood. Ravenswood is kind of interesting. That, I think they burn oil brought in from Venezuela. Not 100% sure on that. Somebody should look into that. But well,
they're talking about
oils.
They're talking about making projects up here where they pump water into a reservoir in the mountains near the Astrakhan, which is where they get a lot of their drinking water, and then
the Ashcan?
Sure, man.
Okay.
The Ashcan. And then letting it go down to
7.